If you hold a stone, hold it in your hand. If you feel the weight.
Dear listeners, my name is Catherine Hogg, and I'm a curator at the Kunsthaus Zurich, Switzerland. This podcast was released as part of the Ligia Clark retrospective at the Kunsthaus on view from November 14, 2025 to March 8, 26. The show was developed in cooperation with the Neue Nationalgalerie in Berlin and is the first comprehensive exhibition of the Brazilian artist's work in the German-speaking world. As a leading representative of neoconcretismo, Clark first expanded the image into space, then sculpture took on an increasingly strong connection to the body, until the representative and object-like artwork was finally abandoned altogether in the 1970s. To this day, Clark's objects and installations allow viewers to become active participants in an enlarged notion of the artwork. She herself said, "For me, creating art is about developing oneself as a human being, which is the most important thing of all. Art should not emulate any name or concept." Quote end. In this podcast series, contemporaries and specialists such as Alessandra Clark, Yvan Lambois, and Irene Small shed light on the great relevance of Clark's work today. Enjoy listening.
We are extremely happy to be holding this conversation with you, Yvalle, on the occasion of the upcoming Ligia Clark exhibition at Kunsthaus Zurich. Many thanks to the kind invitation of the curator, Catherine Hook. We mentioned to Catherine that we are working with the publishing house No Place Press, its publishers Rachel Turner and Jeff Kaplan, and the artist Janie Thompson on a translation and reprint of the two French journals, Robe and Macula, that you edited with Jean Clay. Robo lasted for 5 issues and was published between 1967 and 71. Macula comprised 4 issues and was published between 1976 and 79.
And of course, working on these reissues of the journals, we want to do more than just facsimile editions. We want to do an exhibition and a kind of contemporary interpretation, which Janie, Rachel and Jeff all are already working with us together. And of course, we all look at this time with a lot of admiration for its political radicalism, not just in art, but of course in dialogue with art criticism and magazine making. And the other reason for this meeting and conversation is, of course, your close friendship with Ligia Clark, whom you met in Paris when you were only 16.
Yeah. By coincidence and kind of sheer luck, we are quite well prepared to record the conversation because we just returned from Sao Paulo, where we were teaching at the University Museum, the Museo Contemporaneo de Universidad, built by Niemeyer. And in the collection, we saw the infamous Max Bill sculpture, with which he won the 1951 prize of the Sao Paulo Biennial in 51. And the neo-concretist manifest, which is central to Ligia Clark, of course, to a certain degree, departs as a reaction to Bill. And the later work by Clark, the Caminando, the walking from 63, overcomes the notion of aesthetic art object. And to some degree, it could be perhaps regarded as an attack or deconstruction of Bill's Möbius strip. Basically, it consisted of instructions to cut Möbius strips out of pieces of papers that would lead to a messy chaos. So apologies that we start with Bill, but since it's for Kunsthaus Zurich, we need to bring up Max Bill, and we are quite curious to learn from you about this complex relation between Clark and Bill.
Oh, she didn't think much about it. I mean, she thought it was funny and that people focus often on that. But she clearly, she clearly conceived the Caminando as a kind of attack on geometry, that's for sure. Because you don't expect what's going to happen when you start the Caminando. You make your Möbius strip, but then what it is you cut it in lengthwise. So you make the Möbius strip in paper, then you take your scissors and you go into from the at the center and you go on cutting lengthwise the thing. And you have to, it comes back to where you were. So either you decide to cut completely and you'll have two movie strip, or you decide to continue cutting your way through, and it will get simpler, you know, like, and in the end, if you do continue to do that, which is always not to come back to your feet, to your where you were, you'll have a big spaghetti ball on the mess of spaghetti on the floor. And she thought it was very funny. She always had a big laugh when she said, I don't know what Bill would think about it or something like that. But she had a sense of humor about this kind of thing, that's for sure.
And of course, like Clark, you knew Sean Clay also since your teenage times, and as you recall out, he was your early mentor.
Yeah.
And the Robo magazine that he started took on this form of fanzines. So a form of publication that serves as a tool typically of communication in subcultures. And these magazines like fanzines rely on and create networks in their making. And the fanzine, of course, also stands in opposition to the bourgeois institutions of art like the High Road newspaper. And it stands in opposition to academic journals and in the field of art history. So we wonder how important Robo was in terms of alliance and this creation, maybe even of a subculture of resistance within the specific climate in Paris of the time. And the climate that was the significance of the 68 protest, of course, and the educational reforms at university. So how important was Robo for community building?
That is hard for me to say, because at the time, you know, contrary to what you have generously mentioned before, I did not take part in the editing of Robo. I was way too young for that. It started in 1966, was 2 years before the events of May 68. And I was not living in Paris at the time. I was living in the south of France, in Toulouse. So I don't know exactly, you know, my mental map of Paris at the time is, you know, not very great. I used to come as often as I could to Paris to go and see shows, and including meeting Jean and all that. But I don't know if I would be the right person to speak about the... But I do remember, we would, Jean and his friends, and sometimes I helped when I was, by chance I was in Paris, would just bring a whole stack of Robo to La Une or to whatever, and people would come and swarm around and grab it. It was full of information that you couldn't find elsewhere, really. And it was extremely, you know, I mean, the level of absolute lack of information in France at the time, in terms of artistic practices of the 20th century, I'm not speaking even of the most recent stuff. They knew there was nothing. There was nothing in the French collections. There was not one Duchamp. There was one, maybe one. There was not a single American painting. I mean, there was nothing in French museums at the time. So the lack of information was extravagant. And so, you know, like when Robo did something about, because Jean, which is interesting, was very friendly with Max Bier, by the way. So there was nothing on Robo, but he did. There's a long text on Loser. Richard Paul Loser, you know, not exactly the same, but nevertheless in the same kind of direction. So, but, you know, nobody in France would have known anything about that except for some, you know, people going to some gallery or whatever. So it was, the lack of information was spectacular. And Robo was opening on, I remember when they published this big dossier on Hans Hacker. Hans Hacker was completely unknown in France. I mean, he was not that well known elsewhere either, but he was unknown in France. And so, of course, the same thing when they did Ligia, it's the first major publication on Ligia Clark ever, anywhere in the world, in terms of sheer quantity of information. And, so there was the sense of richness of the, or the informed the French people at the time, which they might have known in the 50s when people like Tapier or whatever they were alive, but people had completely forgotten about Guttai, you know, and there was this little dossier on Guttai. I mean, I can multiply the way. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So there was that, and then there was the political side, which is also very, very left, which was, and the necessity to link the two, the artistic avant-garde and the political avant-garde, was something very new in France at the time. Because on the great majority, the left was extremely traditional in terms of artistic culture.
Yes, because it was more than just information. Yeah. That's what the question was a little bit hinting on. If it created a kind of subculture network movement, like from Latin America to Japan, if it felt like connected at this time.
I think that was an effect that it had, yeah. People felt, And then when, after 68, Which one of the things which was which is interesting to remember with regard to Robot is, well, there was a lot of link with the Groupe de Recherche d'Art Visuel, and in the Groupe de Recherche d'Art Visuel at the beginning, and in the Groupe de Recherche d'Art Visuel, there was this all element of playfulness and humor and doing kind of performances, you know, in the streets with you know, there was a lot of that, and that Robot did organize this kind of thing. In fact, there is a whole, I don't know which issue it is, but there's a whole page full of proposals for this kind of exhibitions to be done, and it's they're all quite funny, including a special exhibition dedicated to plagiarism, or you know, we will provide you for the how to make a falsive crown or whatever, you know, this kind of thing. So there was an element of playfulness that was very much important in would become and that's part of the legacy, important in May 68. There was a lot of play in the theory, even of, you know, like, for example, the events of May have a lot to do with situationism, and in, you know, in the Bible of the situationist play is very, very important as a kind of escape to bourgeois rationality, etc., etc. So Robot was, you know, he was always gravitating around those things as well, and they had a public in the kind of rebellious École des Beaux-Arts also. They were very. Robot actually invited Nepomene, who was that was a journal that was going to be cancelled, censored by the École des Beaux-Arts, but it was a journal of published by the kind of fanzine published by the finishing level of the students in architecture at the École des Beaux-Arts. And so when the journal was censored, Robot offered them a double page to do, you know, to do something. And they did something on Buchmistr Fuller, who also was completely unknown at the time in France. So there was a kind of excitement about the high, you know, the kind of unbelievably well-connected perception or activities around the world that Jean, it was really Jean Clay, frankly, but almost entirely by himself, who did all that. I mean, you know, Julien Blaine was, in, you know, did things, but it had to do with, there was more with poetry and all that, and Alain Chiffre for theater, but really the main body of the entire journal was this kind of curiosity of Jean, and nobody knew exactly how he found all these things, you know, how he knew about all these things, but he was very, very, very omnivorous.
And the first text we read by you, which really attracted us as students, was your essay Painting the Task of Mourning, which was published 1986 in the group exhibition catalogue Endgame. And we were curious, would you say that the early encounter with Clark, an artist so radically attacking the condition of how an artwork is perceived, would shape your later interest in artists that deal with the end of painting or the artwork itself? And if one looks at the Robot issues, the end is kind of a recurring theme, the end of galleries, the end of painting already early on. So we're curious if this friendship to Clark inspired the work.
I never thought about it. Because if I well remember, the argument of the essay is that it's a recurrent end. It always has to end. You always have to invent your new way of killing, because it's never going. It's actually ending, but it's perpetually ending. So it's a kind of like it's almost a trope that you need to figure out the end in order to continue. But I don't know, if Lisa, I don't know. I mean, She at that time when I met her, she really considered that. I met her just after she was coming back from the Venice Biennale. She was completely depressed. She had just arrived. She had just got there with the boxes coming from I suppose from Brazil to an atelier which was from the Ville de Paris, Centre International des Arts. It's this ugly building on the Seine. She had a you know, studio there, studio apartment there. And it was full of, when I arrived, she was just coming from Venice, but at the same time coming from Brazil, where all our boxes and all that. So nothing was really unpacked. And she started unpacking, you know, and she felt that in many ways she, you know, she didn't deserve to have an artist studio. She said, perfectly fine, I can work whenever I want, but, you know, it's not really my world anymore. So she was kind of the verge already of leaving the art world. And she was still going to have a show in Germany. I think, by Udo Kulterman at Essen, I think. But I think that was the last time. After that, she said that I don't want to do art world things anymore. It's not my interest. And then later on, she got this teaching job at the Sorbonne, as she said very proudly. It had nothing to do with, well, all the, after May 68, the La Sorbonne was divided into, all the University of Paris were named Sorbonne, even if they were elsewhere. So Sorbonne, there were the Sorbonne 1, the Sorbonne 2, you know. But so she was in the Sorbonne, whatever, 3, I guess. She enjoyed very much that, this relationship with students and all that. But she didn't feel that making objects made any sense anymore at that time. So, when I met her, she was going into that position, but not quite yet, because I met her in 68. But 2 or 3 years later, or 3 years later, let's say, when I was living in Paris and I saw her daily, she was, art world is, I don't have anything to do anymore with that. And when there was a curator, the museum director, that wanted to do an exhibition, a retrospective of her work, she refused. I was there. It was kind of clear that she didn't want to be part of a museum culture. And she did accept later on, when in Brazil, before she died, but in very special, I don't know the way they do the show in Germany or in Zurich, but she was there, and you had the original of the, those objects, which are not exactly objects that were there, but you couldn't touch them. But then you have all the other ones, all the material to make your own that was on the table. And she was there discussing, telling people what to do. So she accepted, and that's the way she wanted to do when this director was there, this museum director. She said, well, I could come, invite me for 3 weeks or for a month in a museum and I'll be there. I'll be perfectly happy. And the guy didn't want that. So that was the end for her. No, it's not, I'm not interested in that. She was not saying that her early work was not interesting, but she was not interested in continuing to present it that way. That was it. She said, it's from the past, and why should I do that now?
And earlier on, we wondered, like next to this question of painting, we wondered, what was this promise that you saw in kinetic art at the time? Because from today's perspective, it's surprising what fundamental role kinetic art played for you, that it today transformed and the forms that you discussed don't exist anymore.
No.
Since.
Well, I think it's, it was very seductive. It was vulgar, frankly, but it was, there was something very seductive. If you're not very enormously well informed about what things are doing. I didn't remain that interested for very long. But, I met, as I said, I was living in the countryside in the south of France. And, Jean introduced me. It was Jean. He was very much into that. He was very close to Denis René and all that. And to his credit, he was the first to recognize, that when it really shifted to something very, very bad. And there was this his art, his big enemy in terms of criticism in France was Popper, Frank Popper, who was, the defending of the most, kind of the type of kinetic art that, that became decoration in airports. I mean, that's what Popper was. And he saw many artists who were interesting gradually evolve into something very decorative and that he dismissed, and he was very, very hurt by the evolution of Soto. Because he thought Soto's beginnings, which is true, were extraordinary. And he saw Soto, especially, he understood the penetrable of the 1969, I think, between, which is very extraordinary, I must say. That was all those nylon threads suspended between the Musée National d'Art Moderne and the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris. All this plaza was basically filled with this nylon thread. And you would go in and you would disappear, you would become like in a cloud. And that was quite impressive. And but he felt that it was the last interesting thing that Soto did, and that after that it became just, basically, junk that. So I think that the seduction of up art for a young, 14, 15-year-old, it's like, it's not, but you have to start with something. And that's true. I didn't stay long interested in that. And by the time I met Ligia, it was, had already more or less gone away from that. I was more like wanting to do Gutai at that time.
I just discovered that the Modern Art Museum in Łódź organized a two-person show with Alicia Clark and Katarina Kobro. And I was quite intrigued by this pairing. You, of course, also worked intensively on Kobro, an artist who even today is kind of rarely studied and rarely exhibited, probably also due to that only 15 works of her still exist. Luckily, the painter, I guess also a colleague of yours, R.H. Kweitman, dedicates recent work to Kobro. And in your essay, you describe that the 1929 sculpture, Composition 4, is for you kind of the ultimate sculpture of the 20th century.
Make those grand statements.
Which, as it, on the one hand, it kind of involves temporality towards the spectator and how it expands into the space. So now we're curious if you see a productive comparison between Ligia Clark and Kobro.
Yeah, I don't remember if Ligia, I don't think that it would have been possible for her to know anything about Kobro. I don't think there's anything in there's nothing in Robot about the Polish group, I don't think. It really became known when their work became known when there was this great exhibition that organized by Łódź and that toured around and went to the Kolomüller in 1976. And that was the first time there was all these major publications and all that. I think that's when the attention was paid to their work. Not much, because there was also an exhibition. I think a little bit of that exhibition went to America, including to MoMA. There was no reviews, nothing. There was no interest really. But in Europe, it started to get interested. But Ligia had left already at the time. I don't remember anything. I mean, she would have been interested. I'm absolutely sure, because there is an understanding of what space can become a material. That is something that Ligia described as well. I mean, you know, how to have basically the void being sculptured. That's something that she was interested in very early on, in fact. So, and some of the Kobro's look, there's a little Ligia look. You know, there's something very interesting. I don't know if it's, I can tell you, and you can cut it if you want. But, you know, Rebecca Quaitman wanted to make a series very early on where using photos of Kobro work, the most geometrical one, which is white, black and gray, and very orthogonal. And for some reason at the time, it was a long time ago, the museum didn't want her to make photographs. So she made a fake Kobro, but to be able to photograph it. She fabricated it in metal, painted on. But I never knew, and she never told me, if it was a mistake or if it was on purpose, but it's mirror reversed. It was based on a photograph that was mirror reversed. So she made a series of photographs in which she used this object. And then what she do with the object, I can't put it in the trash because if someone picks it, they're going to sell it as a Kobro. So she gave it to me. So I have this fake Kobro in my office.
So good.
It's a Kobro, but you know, you have to imagine it, reverse it in mirror, but it still functions well.
I think it also matches my next questions, and we soon have to also then maybe we each have one more question, then we probably have to end. But kind of making from this copy and being curators ourselves, we are of course also very curious about your own curatorial practice. And then, exhibition making seems an important element to your work. In this regards, we also have to think of the museum model by Manolo at the Reina Sofia and this ambition of transforming the museum from a respiratory of knowledge to a producer of knowledge. This intention can be related to the different institutions of art, like art history, art criticism, and of course the making of a magazine. Did Ligia Clark's form of deconstruction of an exhibition and institutional vocabulary give also you a kind of a method of your own curatorial way of working?
I don't know how I could respond on that. I don't know if it's my way of doing. I mean, I'm trying, when I do an exhibition, there are several possible approach. One of them is the most simple one, which is thematic or chronological, or, you know. But what I always like to do is having object that whose dialogue makes him, you know, make something appear new, make something produces new knowledge. But I don't know if Ligia would have been. I don't know if she was in. Personally, I don't see the connection between what she thought about exhibition and the way I do it. Sorry, I'm like a, maybe I have to think more about it, but I'm a little fuzzy at the moment, so I don't have any.
Maybe your relation to the Rainer Sophia and Manolos.
Well, you know, his exhibitions are really, it was like very, a lot of an opening up of, you know, you would take an object and construct 10 rooms out of one thing. I mean, he would just, every object, every topic would be immediately multiplied in all possible directions. Mm-hmm. So he has a kind of, it's very Deleuzean in a way, his way of understanding the evolution of an exhibition. It becomes a kind of networks that multiply. Just like, it's like a big, thing that endlessly, it's like cells that multiply in all directions. And, you know, and I remember I have a very good example, which I think I mentioned in an article I wrote for In Defense of Manolo, which is there was an absolutely disgusting Dali show at the Pompidou. And it came to the Hagia Sophia, and you know, I was there, and I was not going to for something else, and I was not going to go and see the Dali show again in Hagia Sophia after having saw it in the Pompidou, where it was truly revolting. I mean, in my own, you know, sense of what you shouldn't do. And then I saw Manolo in the staircase. No, no, you should go and see it. It's a bit different. It was completely different. It was fascinating. It was a lot of things that nobody knew about Dali. It was really, I mean, a font of knowledge just produced. It was just extraordinary. So he has this knack of multiplying. In a way, he's not that different from Jean. That's true. Mm. Kind of multiplication in all directions. Yeah, true.
And maybe to close our conversation with a more romantic question, reading your oblique autobiography, it's really touching how close you are to artists, how you really collaborate with them. You're kind of in an alliance with artists, or you even act as their advocates. And to me, this is quite unusual. In our art history education, it felt quite distant. Art history to, let's say, art world artists. To exaggerate, many of the art historians I encountered, they were perhaps even suspicious towards the artist.
Oh, yeah.
And you would publish like artist writings by the like of Ligia Clark. Mm. So I'm quite curious how you would see this. Does it kind of stem from the fact that you yourself used to be an artist at the beginning of your career?
That was not for a very short time, and a mediocre one. No, it might stem with the fact that I was never trained as an art historian. I never studied art history, except if you could call that studying art history for participating for 3 years in a seminar of Damisch. That's the only thing. I don't have any purely autodidact. So I don't have the, you know, this kind of, I have an idea, oh, no, don't touch the art, the recent art, because it's going to, I don't know what do to your brain. So I never had, you know, that. So it's true that my approach to the history of art was always through the point of view of artists, in fact. And that's one of the characteristics of Jean, amazingly enough. Because Jean is also a complete autodidact, even more than me. He didn't even go to the baccalaureate, I mean, you know, visiting an exhibition with Jean is like visiting an exhibition with an artist. It makes you, did you see this little, you know, the way he used the palette knife here? I mean, he has this kind of completely myopic look at works of art, which I think many artists have. And they are, you know, I love going to see shows with artists because they point you to things that you maybe not overlook because it's not your, you know. So yeah, it's true that I prefer the point of view of the artist to the point of view of the historian. It's true. But I like the idea that you can combine the two, frankly. And I think that both points of view can learn from each other. I mean, that's always been my kind of goal, really. Is that okay?
Oh, thank you so much. I think this was an ideal closing.
Okay, very good. All right, okay.
Thanks for the time.
See you.
Have a good day. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Hold it in her hand. If you feel the weight, Marietta, you'll never be late, Marietta. to understand.
This podcast series was conceived by Katrin Hoog and produced by Kim Stengel, with a song dedicated to Ligia Clark by Gaetano Veloso from 1971. We would like to thank the speakers, further also Christiane Klutz and Klaus Kovac, as well as the directors of the respective institutions and the Minister for the Kunsthaus Zurich and Klaus Biesenbach for the Neue Nationalgalerie. Copyrights are with the Zürcher Kunstgesellschaft and the speakers. Para ser feliz, cadê meu sol dourado? E cadê as coisas do meu país?